Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special 200th episode of the Atlas Society Asks. My name is Jennifer Anju Grossman. My friends call me JAG. I'm the CEO of the Atlas Society. We are the leading nonprofit introducing young people to the ideas of Ayn Rand in fun, creative ways, music videos, animated videos, graphic novels. I'm coming to you from Philadelphia, so apologies for the less than glamorous digs here in my hotel room. We're going to be joined by Dr. Judith Curry coming to us from Reno, Nevada. Before I even begin to introduce our guest, I want to remind all of you who are joining us on Zoom, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, you can use the comment section to type in your questions and we will get to as many of them as we can. Dr. Judith Curry is president and co-founder of Climate Forecast Application Network, she's a leading global thinker on climate change. Dr. Curry is author of the book Climate Uncertainty and Risk: Rethinking Our Response. Highly recommend, also has an excellent audio version. Now, Dr. Curry was targeted by the cancel culture mob for research at variance with the conventional narrative on matters related to the weather and climate. She is a professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where she served as the chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for 13 years. Judith, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. Delighted to be joining you this afternoon.
So we were chatting a little bit before that we went live, and you among the reasons that you were excited to come and join us here at the Atlas Society was that you had an experience when as a young person on a couple of your breaks reading Ayn Rand. So maybe if you'll just tell us a little bit about that to set the stage.
Okay, well, when I was a sophomore in college, one of the girls on my dorm floor was just raving about Ayn Rand books, Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. So I bought the Fountainhead to read over Thanksgiving break, and I read it from cover to cover without coming up for air, without sleeping, without talking to my family, and I was, just stunned. It was just mind opening about so many things. And then so the follow-up act was to read Atlas Shrugged over Christmas break, cover to cover, nonstop, 30 hours without sleeping. And I read it so fast that I knew I had to read it again more slowly. So as soon as I finished it, I immediately started rereading, only this time more slowly. And so, it was. And it really, I mean, the whole thing, and it just helped me strengthen the courage of my convictions. And, it was very influential to me as a young person. And I recently reread The Fountainhead, coming at it with a very different perspective. And I had a very different, reaction. And it was really cool to go back and think about how I was reacting 50 years ago when I was reading it the first time. And, and so like I reread The Fountainhead, it was about 9 months ago. So like when I
Yeah.
was contacted by the Atlas Society, I mean, I was just really excited to join you for this interview.
Well, you talked about some of the favorite characters from the literature, Hank Reardon, and of course, perhaps most importantly, Howard Roark. And whether consciously or unconsciously, when you came to these junctures in your career, and you were being told to conform and to just kind of repeat what the conventional wisdom, what others wanted you to say, that like Howard Roark, your integrity wouldn't let you to do it. So I thought that was just interesting. Now, in terms of my first encounter of your story, you landed on the radar thanks to a recent interview that we did with Catherine Brodsky. She's the author of No Apologies, to find you and free your voice in an age of outrage for the silenced majority. And the book contained several profiles of people from all walks of life who experienced various attempts at canceling them or marginalizing them and how they dealt with it. But the chapter for me that really stood out was about you, because the evolution of your thinking about climate science really illustrates what I think is a true academic temperament and intellectual integrity, and what you suffered as a result of that illustrates the polar opposite. So maybe you can take us back to how that really started for you. If I understand correctly, that this began around 2005, when you began engaging with blogs run by climate skeptics that were critical of your work, and you wanted to understand their criticism. That it was about a paper that you co-authored in Science. So maybe talk a little bit about that paper and what the fallout was, and how one thing led to another.
Okay, well, prior to 2005, I was comfortably ensconced in the ivory tower, just doing my research. And, I was aware of the whole climate change debate. And I just oh, that's politics. And I dismissed it. I didn't take it seriously. So in 2005, I was co-author on a paper that for the first time assembled a data set on global hurricane intensity. And, we analyzed it, and we have found a rather shocking result, is that the percent of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes had increased dramatically since 1970. Okay. And just by sheer fluke, this paper was published 2 weeks after Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans. So the message of our paper, and in our even our initial press conference, was really about not a global warming message, but said, as you think about rebuilding New Orleans, just don't look at Category 3 protection. You may need to think about Category 4 and 5. That was the main message we wanted to get across. But everybody just took the whole global warming implications and ran with it. And the significance, people were saying, oh, 1 or 2 or even 3 degrees of warming, who cares? That kind of warming, temperature
change. Abstract, hard to think, think about it.
Yeah, it happens from day to day. But if a couple of degrees of warming can cause a lot more Category 4 and 5 hurricanes, for the first time, people sort of, it became concrete and they became worried. So this, was a major global warming focusing event. And, the media attention was just overwhelming. And this was before the era of Zoom. We had CNN and all, television cameras in my office, sometimes 2 times a day, 2 different stations a day. And this went on for weeks, our 15 minutes, went on for weeks and months. And
you said you were kind of a rock. You became climate science. Yeah.
The whole idea that you can use extreme weather events to amp up the alarm about climate change, global warming. Wow. Okay, this is really cool. So the whole, environmental movement, the climate alarmists, advocates, and whatever, really picked up on this and shepherded me around. And at some point, I backed off. I was giving, I felt it was my responsibility to communicate with people about this. And, at some point, I just didn't like this whole scene. I stopped giving interviews and I backed off. And I even published a paper trying to understand, the craziness of what happened. It was called Mixing Politics and Science and Addressing the Hypothesis, whatever. And when that was published in 2006, I mean, it wasn't like newsworthy in terms of the mainstream media, but it was picked up by tons of blogs. So I went around to every blog, that was talking about the paper, and, I engaged with them, and I landed on a blog called Climate Audit, and the people were asking me all sorts of questions. questions. Oh, can we see the data? And what about this or that statistical significance kind of thing? And I go, oh, wow, there's some really sharp people here. And I said, why haven't I heard of this blog before? And then I realized that I was on the blog of Steve McIntyre, who's the arch enemy of what I would say the real climate, the alarmed wing of the climate thing, because he had been criticizing the hockey stick, the climate hockey stick. If you know what that is, it's a paleo climate reconstruction back for 1,000 years that showed no variability until boom, it started shooting up in the 20th century. And this was the blog where, people were criticizing this, and the mainstream climate community regarded climate audit and Steve McIntyre as the Antichrist. But I thought these guys are really smart. They dig deep, and I started engaging with them and whatever. And, there were criticisms made of our paper, which I felt were valid, but I, continued engaging with them in a low-level way. I even wrote some guest posts on climate audit. Now, a lot of this was below the radar screen, but all this changed on November 2009. And for the younger viewers, you may not have ever heard about ClimateGate, but this
Right. So
was
I
a
think we
pretty
do need
big,
to, yes,
I need to
set
hear
that
about
stage.
ClimateGate. Okay, so in November 2009, this was about a week before Thanksgiving, hackers or somebody got into the emails at the University of East Anglia in England. And these were a bunch of authors of the IPCC, the UN climate assessment reports. And what these emails revealed were scientists trying to evade Freedom of Information Act requests, trying to rig the peer review process, bypassing the regulations for the UN climate assessment reports, and generally trying to sabotage anyone who disagreed with them, particularly Steve McIntyre. So this was cancel culture in action, at a very early stage, in the first decade of the 20th century. This was all, behind the scenes. Nowadays, cancel culture goes on, out in the open under Twitter, but they were working behind the scenes in a cancel culture sort of way. And, when this was made public, I mean, it had a huge impact. I mean, it derailed climate legislation in the US, the Waxman-Markey bill that was pending. And okay, they didn't even bring it forward after this happened. And it was major egg on the face. And I was really concerned by this. I mean, I was appalled, but I was worried about the implications for the UN climate negotiations. I was worried about the appearance of the integrity of climate science. But most importantly, I was worried about the students. What are the students to make of all this? So I wrote a series of three essays addressing those topics, and one of them was even picked up by the New York Times. And what I was trying to promote was make the data publicly available, be completely transparent in your methods, pay careful attention to the uncertainties, don't be overconfident in your conclusions, and finally, be respectful of people who disagree with you and maybe even listen to them. This sounds like motherhood and apple pie,
Right. What's
but
so controversial about that?
okay, people felt that single-handedly I was about to destroy this whole big consensus on global warming that the scientists, the activist scientists, had worked to develop for the past 20 years. Like, little old me can, demolish this whole climate consensus. So I was regarded, I mean, I got a lot of media attention, and, the important people were very upset. They were trying to marginalize me. They were trying to figure out how to attack me. The first strategy, I mean, she's not a good scientist. She's a female, sleeping her way to the top, and all these innuendos like that. And that didn't really take off. And then they had the idea to just call me a denier, put her in the camp with the crank scientists and the oil companies. And that way we can, just dismiss her. And that took off like wildfire. All the activists, journalists, climate denier Judith Curry, even like Washington Post and outlets like that, if they were mentioning me, well-known climate denier Judith Curry.
Oh my
Okay,
goodness.
So I was immediately, you know, so I, you know, by 2013, you know, I was, my reputation had been completely smeared by these people calling me all sorts of names.
So I mean, what was the denouement for you at Georgia Tech, where again, you served as chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for more than a dozen years? Did that?
Yeah. Okay. Well, there was an op-ed in the Huffington Post, and this was in, I guess it was 2013. It was written by Michael Mann, and it was about, you know, climate deniers, what, and it referred to me as serial climate disinformer Judith Curry. Okay. So Georgia Tech had this daily news feed. So anytime anyone was mentioned in the media, this would be added, you know, to the news feed in an email. And this email would be sent out to all the faculty, students, staff, administrators, alumni, donors, the works. Okay, very prominently on this daily news feed with Judith Curry, serial climate disinformer. Okay, everybody, you know, my faculty members, my students, not to mention the administrators. And at the time, I was under consideration for a post in the higher administration at Georgia Tech. Now, after that came out, it was game over, you know, and I was just shocked. And I reflected and I said, wow, I Googled my name, Judith Curry. And the first 10 entries, it's all Judith Curry, climate denier, climate heretic, Judith Curry, you know, the whole first 10 entries were all this stuff. And I go, wow, this is really bad for Georgia Tech's brand. Then not only that, but it made me essentially unhirable at any other university. So I said, okay, you know, the writing's on the wall. I mean, I have two choices. One, I can play the game and, you know, recant and try to, you know, join the club again. You know, I could just be quiet and try to suck up my salary at Georgia Tech for as long as I could before they tried to figure out a way to get rid of me. Or I could just leave. Okay. So
you could shrug. You could go golf.
Shrug. There you go. You know, and so a few years ago, I had started my company, Climate Forecast Applications Network. I said, I'll go for full time with the company. And I took a big salary hit, but it was the best decision I ever made. I'm off doing my own thing. I don't have any peers to placate. I just have my clients to work with. And they want the real deal. They don't want any politicized games or whatever. They want the real deal. And they want to know, well, what's the uncertainties? How confident should I be in that? So I'm in a much happier place than I was at the university. You're right. I didn't think about it that I shrugged. Yeah, I shrugged. I shrugged off my academic appointment.
You went gold. Or another way of thinking about it is like Howard Rourke. You know, you spent time in the rock quarry, you know, you suffered various attempts to cancel you.
But the building. Yeah, I bombed the building, you know, when I wrote
to them.
The essay
to them.
About climate change. Yeah.
Right. But at the end, you find yourself, you know, you're up on the edifice that you yourself have created. You're finding the clients who want what you are providing, which is in this case, fact-based research and reporting. And so you're in a better place. So I want to turn to this again, magnificent achievement of your book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response. The political debate on implementing climate policies has become extremely contentious, to say the least. It's often framed as between those who want to move us aggressively to net zero emissions and those who, as they are caricatured, want to let the world burn. So let's talk about some of these policy recommendations. How impactful would they be if we were to move away from fossil fuel and, you know, for example, meet the aggressive goals that Biden or, you know, Governor Newsom and various people have have set out? Would they be impactful? And is this even the debate we ought to be having?
Okay, let me go back to you mentioned the word framing, and that's a key issue. This whole debate was framed back in the 1980s before we had any idea what we're doing, that climate change was driven by fossil fuel emissions and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that warming was dangerous, and that we needed to eliminate fossil fuels. I mean, this was a very narrow framing. I mean, it neglected natural climate variability. It presuppose that warming is dangerous. There are actually benefits to warming to greater CO2 in the atmosphere. And it presupposed that the preferred policy was to urgently get rid of fossil fuels. So this was framed in a very bad way from the very beginning. The correct framing is that we have three separate problems. Okay, one is extreme weather, which climate warming has very little to do with it. Then we have climate change, which is the slow creep of warming, relates to the slow creep of sea level rise and some glacier melting. And then we have energy policy. I mean, the presupposition that energy policy should be dictated by this very narrow framing of the climate change problem is a huge mistake. I mean, energy policy, I mean, energy is a foundation of everything that we're doing. We wouldn't even be having this conversation on Zoom if it weren't for electricity. So it was just a very big mistake to frame the whole climate change issue in this way. The proposed policies, okay, even if we were to somehow reach net zero by 2050, we wouldn't notice any change in extreme weather, or even the slow creep of sea level rise and glacier melting until the 22nd century. The time scales in the ocean and the ice sheets are very long. I mean, we would, even if we were able to accomplish this, and even if this would be as impactful as they think it might be, we wouldn't feel any difference until the 22nd century. So it just, the whole thing doesn't make any sense. Because it doesn't make any sense, we're between a rock and a hard place with, UN officials and President Biden saying code red, the highway to climate hell, existential threat. But the policies that they put out are not technologically, economically, or politically feasible. So what are we supposed to do? Shrug would be a good thing to do.
So you mentioned the UN when it comes to climate change and human impact. The science has largely been defined by assessment reports from the United Nations and the US government. What are those reports? How are they compiled, and how reliable are they?
Okay, the most impactful one and prestigious one is the International Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC. And this is under the auspices of the UN, and it's an internationally prepared document every 5 or 6 years. In fact, there's three separate documents. One is on the physical basis, the second one is on impacts, and the third one is on mitigation. The Working Group One reports on the physical science basis, there's a lot of good material deep in the reports. It's narrowly framed. They don't pay enough attention to natural climate variability and they cherry pick. But the real problem is with the summary for policymakers. This is the one that everybody reads. And what they do is the lead authors from the IPCC get in a room with the policymakers and the international climate negotiators, and they go over line by line. And the policymakers often put pressure on them. Oh, we need it to be like this. And the worst case of this was in the second assessment report in 1995, when the scientists found, well, we're not seeing anything beyond natural variability. But the policymakers were saying, no, we need more, to support these treaties that we're putting into place. And so they agreed to add the word discernible, that we're seeing a discernible impact of fossil fuel emissions on the climate. And then they had to go back and changed the rest, you know, the rest of the report, the body of the report, to be consistent with that. So this is, I mean, you've heard of science-driven policy. Well, this is policy-driven science. This is what we've been, okay? So it's very, you know, the policy cart has been way out in front of the scientific horse from the very beginning. So yes, there is some good material in there, but the bottom line is that the main conclusions are cherry-picked and amped up, and then they're made extremely alarming by UN officials, and then the activist mainstream media just takes it and runs with it, and, you know, you end up with a lot of alarm. So what the public consumes is carefully crafted alarmist spin, you know, by the time, you know, the public sees any of this. So and it's perverting the science, and it's leading to bad policy decisions. Not a good place to be.
All right. We have a lot of questions that are coming in for Dr. Curry from all corners of the internet. I'm going to grab a couple of those here. On Facebook, Jean Meyer asks, what do you suggest to people interested in studying weather and climate, but avoid all the politics and global warming talk? So I'm not sure if she means interested in actually, yeah, the university or, right, you know, so if you're interested as a civilian in studying it, read Dr. Curry's book.
Okay. Avoid anything, a degree program with the word climate in it. Look to the core disciplines, geology, oceanography, atmospheric science, geophysical sciences, and then you can get a good education in the basic understanding of what drives climate. If it's a climate studies or something like that, you're going to learn very little science. Most you'll learn how to recite IPCC talking points, but then you'll go on to alarmist impacts and all of this stuff that's very soft core. So too many of the people that call themselves climate scientists really know very little about actual climate science. So stick, email me if you want some specific recommendations for university programs that I would recommend. There are some good ones out there that are hardcore.
Glad to know that there still are. Okay, on LinkedIn, Kristen Wright asking, do you think science has become politicized? And if so, do you think it is new or has it been happening for a long time?
Well, climate science became politicized in the 1980s. Okay. And it
basically, long time.
Yeah, it's basically the health fields and environmental fields have the ones that have been politicized for the longest time. These are the ones that have public policy impacts. So you're obviously going to, you know, interface with politics. You know, the science is policy relevant, but mixing science and politics can be a very, very bad recipe, with both the policymakers and the scientists being culpable. You know, with the policymakers, you know, really asking, you know, wanting scientists to support particular policies and directing funding in that direction, et cetera. And then on the other hand, you've got scientists playing power politics with their expertise. And both of those can lead you down a very bad path. And this is what we've seen with climate change and also most recently with the whole COVID situation.
Well, I want to segue into that. And I'm going to, again, don't worry, folks, I see all of your questions, but you've talked a little bit about COVID and the science of COVID and in your book. Did you see parallels with, you know, you've been very critical of manufactured consensus, right? That you need to be able to not reach a consensus before listening to people who are bringing different research and different perspectives, and the kind of rush to consensus is really in part an effort to favor one narrative and exclude other views. Did we see that? I mean, it sounds pretty similar to me when I'm thinking about,
Oh, yeah.
the
Okay.
FOIA requests and, we need the devastating takedown of people like Jay Bhattacharya and Ioannidis and all people that kind of were questioning the consensus or the science.
Okay, well, there's a difference between a scientific consensus, something that's essentially a fact, the Earth orbits the sun. You don't even need to talk about a consensus there, versus a consensus of scientists, which is a manufactured consensus where a group of scientists come together and agree on something, either under their own steam or at the behest of policymakers. And, the IPCC consensus on climate change is explicitly a manufactured consensus as part of their charter. But the interesting one in COVID, I mean, this was in spring of 2020, just when this was all starting to happen. There were two papers published, one in the New England Journal of Medicine, and I think the other one in Journal Science, where groups of health scientists, epidemiologists got together to declare a consensus that this was natural origin, that anybody talking about a lab origin was a conspiracy theorist, anti-Chinese and racist, and on it goes. And this became immediately accepted. Anybody who said, wait a minute, they became deplatformed from Twitter and Facebook, and on it goes. A few of them even lost their jobs. Okay. And about 10 months later, an investigative journalist, said, wait a minute, let's look at this. Apparently, the lead authors on these papers, one of them was actually funding the research in the Wuhan lab. And he was where, I mean, he really wanted to squash, anything related to a lab origin. Okay, we have some conflicts of interest here. And they kept digging and digging. And once this came out, then all the epidemiologists said, of course, we never believed that it was, that we could rule out a lab origin, but nobody wanted to speak up because they didn't want to lose their funding, their jobs, or be deplatformed or whatever. I mean, they were, but then, so it's not, two things are amazing. How quickly a consensus was declared, okay, and how quickly it then unraveled, and the detrimental impact that that had on this. And everybody was speaking with one voice about totally wrong things, that it was touching surfaces and masks and on it goes, and that lockdowns were needed, and on it went. Even beyond when there was objective evidence that these things just are not working, are not necessary, have adverse impacts, they were all speaking with one voice saying we had to do this. They knew where their what side their bread was buttered on. If they want, funding from the National Institute of Health, I mean, this is what you have to go along with. So it was a very bad situation. And it was very interesting to watch the COVID thing unravel on the time scale of months, whereas the whole climate thing is unrolling over decades. So it was this little microcosm of everything that went wrong in the climate debate, smashed into a year or two in the COVID debate.
And I think that we have seen some of that manufactured consensus unravel with regards to COVID origins. There does seem to be people coming around to recognizing that, yes, there were trade-offs, and actually the lockdowns did, marginal, if any, maybe negative benefits in terms of their reported purposes with disease mitigation, but they had these terrible consequences in terms of learning and economic damage and mental health and all of that. I'm not sure we are seeing the consensus unravel with regards to the efficacy of masks and mask mandates, but perhaps we just have to wait a little bit longer. All right. My modern gal on Instagram is asking, do you think it is easier or harder to push back against the climate change activists today, in the past? Maybe we could combine that question with the whole and some of the positive things that have made it easier to debate and,
Well, the whole climate, I mean, prior to 2007, I mean, people weren't paying that much attention. It was really Al Gore's movie, The Inconvenient Truth, and also the IPCC Fourth Assessment Report, which came to stronger conclusions that really took this to the top of the international agenda. So before 2007, it was easier to ignore. I would say since President Obama's second term in the US, it's sort of harder to ignore. You know, it's out there, it's a very big deal. And, you know, journalism, there's been so much money put into journalism on the climate issue, funded by people with an alarmist perspective, that it's all you get in the media is the alarmist perspective. You know, if you're a researcher and you want to advance in your career, it's very obvious, you know, what you need to do. And it's not, you just can't criticize the establishment, but, you know, to the extent that you advocate for the, you know, mainstream narrative, you know, you will be rewarded, you know, with being directors of big centers and professional recognition, and on it goes. So, I mean, the career path is very much easier for somebody who's of the alarmist persuasion. And, you know, it can be pretty much cut short if you overtly challenge the mainstream narrative. So the biggest change is, you know, when Elon Musk took over Twitter. You know, I was shadow banned on Twitter and
Really?
Facebook.
Wow.
Oh yeah. For a long time, you know, I was tweeting into the void. You know, when you know, I wasn't getting any new followers, hardly anyone would view, hardly I got. And as soon, you know, within a week after Elon Musk taking over, you know, tons of new followers, engagement, people are saying, oh, I didn't realize Judith Curry was still on Twitter. I haven't seen anything from her in ages. And but still on Facebook and YouTube, some of my stuff is banned. You know, in terms of interviews and whatever, they will still ban me on YouTube and Facebook. But you know, so God bless Elon Musk for, you know, opening all this up and giving people with alternative perspectives an opportunity to engage in the dialogue and reach a broader audience. It's really critical. I can't understate how important it was what Elon Musk is doing with Twitter.
All right, this is kind of a technical question that is over my head, but I will ask it anyway. And if you want to take a crack at it, great. Or if not, we can return to your to some of what you covered in your book. On Zoom, Bruce Brown asks, is it true that NOAA fabricates climate temperature data for 30% of the 1200 USHSCN climate stations no longer exist, but NOAA estimates temps for from the stations now not functional
Okay,
stations.
not quite as simple as that. You know, weather observations at certain locations come and go. You know, that they may be there for 30 years and then they stop collecting right there. In processing the temperature data, NOAA does this homogenization thing to try to extend the record in sensible ways. Am I a fan of what NOAA is doing? Not particularly, but they're not, you know, deliberately fabricating. They're trying to use statistical methods to get better space and time coverage for the surface temperature observations. Is this very accurate or reliable, or do I like it? Well, not really, but that there are better approaches. Yeah,
Okay.
so it's not
Well,
quite as
so
bad as some of the headlines make it seem, but I don't particularly like it either.
there would be a better, you would design it better. Okay. So one of the things that you covered in your book was the 2 degree target, the international climate policy goal of limiting global warming to then 2 degrees Celsius. Compared to pre-industrialization levels, How did this target evolve and how valid is it?
Well, I mean, it's just a political choice. The choice of to reference things to the pre-industrial period is an interesting one in itself. Like the 18th century, I mean, this was in the Little Ice Age. It was the coldest period of the last 1,000 years. I mean, think Valley Forge and George Washington and the horrible winters that he endured. I mean, the weather and climate was horrible during that period. It was much worse being colder, and trying to make that out like that was some Goldilocks climate is rather a joke. I think the warmer climate that we have now is actually better, which brings us to the whole issue of, Goldilocks. What climate do we really want? But okay, so the 2 degrees centigrade, okay, we've already warmed since pre-industrial by 1.2 degrees centigrade. Okay, so we're already more than halfway there. And, over that period, humans have thrived. Population has increased by, five times. The percent of people in poverty is way down. Agricultural productivity is way up. A far smaller percentage of people lose their lives from weather and climate disasters. So, overall, things are much better than they were even 100 years ago. So, thinking that warming is dangerous, it's really a little bit hard to justify. So this whole idea of 2 degrees, it's politics. It's trying to balance. If it's too stringent, then people will throw up their hands and say, we can't reach it. And if it's too high, people will say, oh, well, we don't have to worry about it now. So it was, a political decision trying to maximize the alarm and the political pressure. And when it looked like we were, and so it was a political decision made not all that long ago, like less than 10 years ago. So all this talk about dangerous climate change in the UN never really defined it, until maybe 2015 when they declared it to be 2 degrees centigrade. Now that it looks like we could maybe stay within 2 degrees centigrade, they've lowered the goalpost to
Oh my
1.5
God.
degrees centigrade. Oh no, we're almost there. It's all politics. These deadlines and thresholds are just pure politics. There's no objective way to decide what temperatures are warmer. In the US, people are migrating from New York and California to Florida and Texas. I mean, people don't like cold winters. So this whole idea that warm is bad is very hard to,
To
objectify.
justify. Yeah.
Science doesn't have much to say about it. It's about people's preferences and it's about politics, not about science.
Think there's probably some other reasons why people are moving from New York to Florida and
Yeah,
Texas.
well,
Probably
political.
not just the weather.
They don't need to move south. They could move to,
They can move to California and they're not doing
or they could
that.
move to the Great Plains, where the politics might be better, but the temperatures are still cold.
That's true. That's true. So a lot of the climate predictions we hear are based on computer modeling. We've seen firsthand some of the failures of computer modeling recently, the models of the British Imperial College driving COVID lockdown policies with devastating economic and social results and questionable benefits. What is computer modeling and what's its role in climate science and how reliable is it?
Okay, well, climate models start with basic laws of physics, Newton's laws of motion, thermodynamics, and they simulate the temperature, the humidity, and the winds, over the globe, where they discretize the grid of the globe. And, so there is physics that goes into this, and they're huge, big computer models, but there's a lot of, the most important things for climate. Clouds being one of them, these are all subgrid scale and they're highly parameterized. So there's not really physics that goes into some of the most important parts of this. And so, climate models are useful tools for research. So we can tweak them and play games with them and to understand how the climate model works. They are not fit for the purpose of predicting future climate. I mean, there's huge uncertainties even about how sensitive the climate is to increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, not to mention they don't deal with natural climate variability adequately. So there's, a lot of inadequacies in these climate models. They should not be used as prediction machines.
All right, I'm going to take another couple of people asking the same question on Facebook and YouTube. I'll take Georgie Alexopoulos asking, what do you think will happen with the Mann versus Stein case, and what does it say for the future of people speaking out?
Oh my gosh. Some backstory. In 2012, Mark Stein wrote an op-ed and basically criticizing the Penn. This was the time of the football scandal at Penn State, molesting a little boys, Jerry Sandusky and whatever. And Mark Stein was writing about, well, we saw Penn State try to whitewash and hide that one. What about, they're probably doing the same thing with the inquiry into Michael Mann. This is a follow-on to Climategate, the hockey stick issue. Is that a whitewash too? And he said words like fraudulent hockey stick. So Michael Mann sued him. Michael Mann has sued other people and threatened to sue other people trying to intimidate people from not speaking out. Well, I mean, this languished for more than a decade in the course. And I was one of the witnesses for Mark Stein, and there was a trial in Washington, D.C. Last January. Okay. And Michael Mann had no case. I mean, suing Mark Stein for $20 million in libel, largely punitive damages. And Michael Mann didn't have a case. I mean, lawyers put on a pathetic case. Mark Stein and his co-defendant Rand Sinberg, they did an excellent job. And they had real scientists and this, that, and the other. They did an excellent job. But this was in Washington, D.C., very heavily Democratic. When I heard when Mark Stein was questioned and that he said that he had guest hosted for Rush Limbaugh and appeared on Fox News, I mean, it was game over with the DC jury. Okay. This guy is a bad guy. And even worse, Michael Mann's lawyer in the closing statement says, you need to help, stop these climate deniers from harassing, real climate scientists. This is climate deniers, just like election deniers. And he played the Trump card. Okay, and this had these jurors so riled up. And so it took them a very short time to come to a verdict. They awarded $1 in real damages and $1 million in punitive damages just because Mark Stein's a bad guy and guest hosted for Rush Limbaugh. So that this was an absolute travesty of justice. Mark Stein's and Rand Sinberg's lawyers are, that this will go on for another decade. But it's a horrible precedent. And I mean, this is all about politics. It's politics all the way down. And the jury was enormously biased that the judge allowed. He just wasn't up to the task. I think the judge might have been well-meaning. He just wasn't up to the task. He allowed, I mean, once the closing statement with election denial and playing the Trump card, I mean, it was just game over in a Washington, D.C. jury. And you can venue shop, you can shop around and for a state or a city where you can expect to find a friendly jury. And the precedent being set here is just horrifying, absolutely horrifying.
We're seeing other examples in other fields of people
I
using
mean,
unfair, right, to try to force political outcomes, and it's really an abuse of our
I mean, the
judicial system.
implications for free speech are horrifying, not to mention the implications for the climate debate and policy and all that. But the free speech implications are horrifying. And I would expect this to go to the Supreme Court, frankly, because of the freedom of implications.
Last week I interviewed John Ellis about his book on the breakdown of higher education, in which he catalogs declining levels of academic rigor in the training of academics, given how many young Many of the scholars raising alarm about the faulty science driving today's alarmism. People of your generation, people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, do you think that the politicized and degraded quality of academic scholarship may be part of the problem here, that people that
Climate science has been subsumed in all these climate studies and environmental studies programs. You know, like I said, previous question, there are some hardcore programs where you can go to get a real rigorous education on the topic. But some, in terms of the sheer volume of people that are being graduated, particularly with master's degrees, in climate studies and environmental studies. These are dominating the field. They're becoming journalists. They're going to work for advocacy groups. They're working in the private sector. They're, you know, congressional staffers. You know, they're just infiltrating everywhere. And what they've, you know, received is just, you know, a very politicized soft core education. And but they call themselves climate scientists. And you know, so what we're getting is just, you know, a continuing, you know, politicized spin rather than real science.
So one of the things that struck me about your book is that it wasn't just about climate science. It was also about science of philosophy. There was psychology in it. It was really about how to think about risk, how to think about uncertainty. I mean, it definitely would appeal to a lot of objectivists who are concerned about critical thinking and epistemology. So maybe talk about that process and in terms of your evolution. Were there things that in working on the book that you learned or changed your mind on issues that you hadn't previously examined?
Well, I'm glad you picked up on that part of it. So, you know, in 2010, following ClimateGate, I started my own blog, climate, et cetera, judithcurry.com. And the idea was not just to open up the discussion to people from all fields and across the spectrum, but I really wanted to explore all of these uncomfortable issues, not just about hard science, but, you know, ethics and social psychology and bias and philosophy of science and all these kind of things. It seems that climate, you know, was such a multidimensional issue with all these things hidden, you know. So my idea was to bring these things out, and I began exploring all these different topics, and I developed a network of people from, you know, legal studies, philosophy of science, on and on it goes. All over the world, you know, and some of them were contributing guest posts on my blog and everything. So I began, it was climate, et cetera, and I was spending a lot of time on the et cetera part of it, you know, not just climate science. And I seeded my blog with a series on climate science and the uncertainty monster. And this was really a philosophy of science series. Okay. And so all of this frame my thinking on the book. And then the other more applied part, you know, risk science, which is something that I was picking up as part of my company. I mean, what I'm fundamentally trying to do is to help my clients better manage their weather and climate risk. And so I was getting more and more steeped, not just in the practical aspects of this, but into risk science. So all these different threads came together in my book in a way that I don't think any other person on the planet would have combined, you know, this combination of things in the way that I did. It's a pretty unique perspective. But, you know, this book sort of chronicles my journey in the post-ClimateGate era as I started, you know, okay, we need to do something different here. What's wrong with what's going on? And I started grappling with all of this. And so this book sort of describes my journey and, you know, culminates with what I came up with. In terms of changing my mind, well, my mind, you know, I learn something on a daily basis, you know, so my mind, everything, this is all pretty fluid. And since I've written the book, you know, there are some things I would have added, changed, whatever. So it's just a process of, you know, exploring so many different things and, you know, weaving all that into my mental model, which is continuing to expand. So in terms of changing my mind, I would say it's more expanding my mind and growing my mental model.
Well, thank you, Dr. Curry, for this time with you, for your insights, for the magnificent achievement of your book. Again, I highly recommend it to this audience, particularly objectivists who want to not only educate themselves about the history and some of the context of the climate debate, but also think how to think critically about these issues that are coming up. And also thank you for, of course, your example of academic integrity and of courage in the face of those who wanted you to conform. And it's definitely, no matter what field you're in, I think it's an example that we all should follow. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
I want to thank everyone who joined us today, who asked such great questions. Of course, if you enjoyed this video, any of our other materials and programming, please consider making a tax-deductible donation at atlassociety.org. And then next week, I will be in Australia, and I am still going to want to encourage you to join Antonella Marti and Rob Trusinski. They are going to be hosting a special current events webinar discussing Javier Milei and what is currently happening in Argentina. So I hope you'll join that. Thanks, everyone.